All right, well, thank you all very much for coming out today. I'm so glad that we have such a lively and excited and full room for a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I'm Patrick Brown. I'm a fellow at the FSU Public Policy Center. We're at Think Tank in D.C. that's just about to celebrate 50 years of advancing a socially conservative agenda, trying to support families and advance the Judeo-Christian principles that are at the heart of what we do in D.C. I'm joined by a rock star panel that we're very excited to engage in some robust discussion as we get into it. But first, let me introduce our guest of honor and the guy who helped sponsor this event today and help make it happen. He is a congressman from Utah's 1st District, served in the Foreign Service. Has 4 kids, so makes him an expert on the child tax credit. Also, more to the point, introduced the Family First Act earlier this year, which is a dramatic and, I think, well overdue re-envisioning of what the child tax credit could look like. So I'll introduce Representative Blake Moore.
I was worried Tim was the only one who was going to clap for me. Once again, my team prepared an amazing speech about 14 really specific bullets for me to hit, and I'm just going to just briefly speak to why and why we're doing this. So thank you for being here. This is actually very well attended. It goes to show you my chief of staff, Rachel Wagley, is in the back. Everybody, Rachel. Her issues become my issues. I actually want my team to know, like, a lot of things I care about, but when my team has something that hits them as hard as something like this does, we'll do whatever we can to make sure this sees the light of day. And when it comes from Rachel, you know it's sincere, you know it's authentic. This is it. I had a little bit of an outburst last week in a meeting where in the speaker's office, there's a round table of people on budget committee, on ways and means committee, and leadership. I actually find myself on all three of those things right now in a very, very unique time, given the fact that we have a reconciliation option. And we were talking about all of the priorities that President Trump had put out when he was on the campaign trail. From tax on tips, to no tax on overtime, to no tax on car loans, apparently. And we're all like, was he in Detroit that day? Was there like a rally in Detroit with some GM folks and the auto workers? Like, what in the world was that? Where'd that one come from? And then, of course, no tax on Social Security. And so we're doing this thing. We can't do anything regarding Social Security in the reconciliation bill because the Byrd rule doesn't allow for it. But we found this workaround to be able to go out and give support for seniors. And I stopped the meeting dead in its tracks. And I said, I've just got to get something off my chest. And I just blurted out, I didn't wait for my time, about when I was in queue to speak. And I said, are we going to care about families anymore? Are we going to care about kids anymore in this country? Do you know what we're spending on seniors versus what we're spending on our youth? And I represent the youngest state in the nation, and we're sick and tired of just pandering to voters. So I went all noble for about 30 seconds. A bunch of staff members have come up to me and said, that was the greatest thing I've ever heard. It was hilarious. And I'm like, I know, it was kind of out of character for me to have an outburst like that. But the point is real. Like, if we don't want to put our policy to direct the type of behavior that we need, there's plenty of research that says people would actually prefer to have more children than they're able to, or they're strapped on being able to do. It's expensive. Life has hit people really hard with regards to cost of living, and it's happened across every single community in our country. People would want to have more children. We have a birth rate that is not replacing itself. Utah's doing its part. So everybody likes to joke that, you know, this is Blake's deal, but it's also J.D. Vance's deal. It's also Josh Hawley's deal. And you've seen from the Trump administration that they want to promote good, strong family policy. This absolutely makes sense. So my team's dug in, and I don't know why that does that. My team has dug in to make this workable, because you can't just increase the child tax credit from where it is right now at 2,000. And next year, if we don't get a tax bill done, it goes back to 1,000. You don't get to 4,200 in a conservative-led Congress without making sure that we reconcile other areas. And that's not easy work to do back here. But given the strong, the nature that we've approached with this, I'm looking at EITC and be like, what is EITC morphed into? It used to be about just, you know, incentivizing work. Well, now it's actually covering whether or not, depending on the size of the family. Like, let's get rid of that. Let's make EITC focus on what it was supposed to, and let's make the child tax credit focus on families. And child development, child tax credit, the CDCTC. Like, that's pigeonholing way too much funding that doesn't allow for flexibility with families to be able to look and say, hey, this actually doesn't work for me, but I still need the relief so I can make sure my kids are educated and they, you know, they can get involved in the youth sports and we can have that flexibility. We've looked at that holistically and we've made it work. So it's budget positive. It could pass muster with regards to budget hawks and anybody that's right. So all the specifics of this bill, like, my team has dug in, and I love the leadership that we've been able to put out on this. And, you know, given our role on Ways and Means, we have a lot of folks unanimous, I think, on the committee. We like the child tax credit. We doubled it in 2017. I hope we don't just land on, let's just extend it. Let's just keep it as is, instead of modernizing it. That's going to be the crux. I don't think we get my version of the bill in this reconciliation. I'm a realist. I get that that's maybe beyond the scope of what we can accomplish, but I really want to move the thinking, and I think that's everybody here's role, is to communicate that we don't want to just accept status quo, double it just because doubling it sounds good. Like, let's really thoughtfully shift this policy so it makes better sense and it will actually encourage the right type of behavior in our country, and that's having more kids. And with that, we have four boys. We really want a girl. We're going to do our part. We just don't want five boys. So we're in a really precarious situation on how this works out. Anyway, so don't be holding your breath on our end. We feel like we've at least done our part, and we've replaced ourselves with those four boys. I said at a recent town hall, and then I'll yield back, that my wife looks at our children as these wonderful souls with inherent value and bring so much joy into our life. And unfortunately, my occupational hazard is I now look at them as future taxpayers. I can't help but now, like, think about, okay, what I got to do to make sure that you're doing a good job within our participation rate. So we improve our benefit to our worker to beneficiary ratio on our massively overspent retirement programs. But that's neither here nor there. Thanks for being involved in this, and do not hesitate to reach out to our team if there's something we can do to help provide the specifics. And as you're talking and socializing this, leverage us as however you can, and I'm happy to lean in and be able to communicate that. It's really important. The Family First Act, the bill that we put out a few weeks ago, is the right piece of legislation. Moving it towards that, using this reconciliation moment to move towards that is a win, in my opinion, and I'm hopeful that with our efforts we can make that happen. And the good news is also this should be highly supported by Dems if they're being honest. So if Dems want to truly engage in an authentic way, they would actually agree with the vast majority of what we have in here. And regardless of what happens in the reconciliation bill, the work can continue on, because we've shown since the mid-90s we're willing to engage and address child tax credit. Let's just not make it about a number. Let's make it about behavior. So thank you.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed the Chick-fil-A, because I think that just about sums up what we were hoping to do here today. Thank you, Congressman. Those were excellent remarks situating where we're trying to focus on. I think based on the size of the room and the wonkiness of the microphone, I think I'm just going to ask our panel to project, and I think we should be okay on that. But we'll pick up right where the Congressman left off in the context of reconciliation. I'm just going to go down the row here with a question for each of our panelists so we can start the discussion. So I'll start with Ramesh right here to my right. Ramesh, you're obviously following the politics of reconciliation very closely. Congressman mentioned some, not even a full list of some of the ideas that were thrown out by Team Trump during the campaign, and we've seen some of their priorities over the last couple weeks is what they're indicating on. Where do you think the opportunity is for the GOP to do more of what the congressman was talking about? And you've written many times about becoming the party of parents and wanting a pro-family agenda. Do you see an opportunity in where we are with the text negotiations right now?
I do, thanks. And I think I can project because I have some practice yelling at my kids. I think all of us do, in fact, so we're not going to have any concerns on that front.
I have very little practice yelling at your kids.
So you haven't spent enough time with them. There remains a strand of Republican thinking on this issue that I think is very wrongheaded. That thinks of the goal of conservative tax cuts as cutting the marginal tax rate in ways that increase the incentive to work, save, and invest, and only doing that. And everything else is a distraction. Any increase in the tax credit for kids is something that you could be plowing into another reduction in the capital gains tax. This has been, and I say this as somebody who is entirely in favor of reducing tax rates on all kinds of margins, including the capital gains tax. The fact is, and this is something that those Republicans with that mistaken mindset forget, every major pro-growth tax reform of the last five decades has included both pro-growth and pro-family elements. They have been balanced packages. If you go back to the Gingrich Republican Congress of 1997, actually it did exactly that. It balanced a capital gains tax cut with the introduction of the first child tax credit. George W. Bush, pro-growth tax cuts, pro-family tax cuts, going all the way up to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. So sometimes you will hear conservatives talk about this as though it's some crazy departure from historical Republican and conservative economics. It is not. It is in keeping with the mainstream conservative tradition, and we need to insist that it continue to be that tradition continues to be followed. Now, one of the reasons why this balance has always been maintained in conservative policymaking is because it's politically necessary. It keeps the social and economic conservatives together. But also, if you did Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 and you didn't have the expansion of the child credit, the distributional tables would have looked terrible. Everything that our guys said as conservatives, oh, this cuts taxes proportionally for people in all income classes, all of that was true only because the child credit was expanded. It looks highly lopsided toward the top end if you don't do that. I suspect that that's going to be true this time again. And that's one of the reasons why even people who have not found the true religion and don't understand the case for pro-family economics end up as Republicans going along with the policy because it's necessary politically. I think that's going to be the case this time too, but we are going to have to continue to have the argument with conservatives who don't see the light.
Well, and to help us see the light, we're very pleased to have Bethany Mandel. She's frequently seen on Fox News, New York Post. She recently wrote a book, co-wrote a book on parents and their attitudes toward COVID and some of the other policies that have happened over the last couple of years. So with your finger on the pulse of where parents are right now, can you speak a little bit to the burgeoning pro-family sentiment in the GOP, and where do you think the momentum is from the grassroots level and some of those conversations that are taking place? Are they being heard in Congress?
So, I mean, if you look at, you know, what happened in Virginia with the gubernatorial race, parents won Youngkin the governorship, and that is something that has come up again and again and again with Republicans, that when they are standing behind families, when they are messaging that they are the pro-family party, that is the path to victory. And we're seeing it on a visual level with Elon Musk and with J.D. Vance. One of the things that I think will go most viral from J.D. Vance's trip to Paris this week. I don't care what he's doing there. I love that he walked down, you're nodding, you know exactly what I'm talking about. He walked down the stairs of the flight with his sons in their pajama pants holding his toddler daughter. That is what makes Republicans relatable. It's what makes us a party that people want to be a part of. Democrats have, you know, talked a lot about families, but not in a really approachable way. And we saw, you know, David Hogg was elected to the chair of the DNC, basically saying in the past, I don't want to have kids because I want to drive a Porsche and I want to do all of these very materialistic things. The Republican Party has a chance, and I think that we're going in that direction of being able to say, like, we are the party of regular Americans, but we have to be able to message it. And the thing that I hear from people again and again about why they've decided to put off children or why they don't want to have children is because they don't feel like our society is setting them up for success. And a lot of that is about financial messaging. And for the Republican Party to come forth and say, we have your back, we understand that you're stressed, and we're going to allow you to keep more of your money. We're not going to slam you quite as hard on your taxes. Because that's what this is. Like, it's not a giveaway program. And it's something to Renesh's point that has bothered me a great deal about Republican opposition to this. There's two things. One is this welfare queens thing that I think has carried over from the Newt Gingrich era. And I don't know anyone on planet Earth who is having a baby in 2025 because they think they're going to cash out. It's hard. I have six kids. It's not easy to be a parent. And I don't think it's based in reality that anyone would go into this with a financial cash out at the end of like, ooh, $3,000 more a year, and all I have to do is not sleep for a year. Like, I don't think that that's appealing. But the other thing that bothers me about Republican messaging on this front is the work requirements and this fixation on the work requirements, because a lot of the times I'm seeing it from Republicans, and it's mind-boggling to me that both parents have to be working. And I'm a quasi-stay-at-home mother, and I have been since my eldest was born. And when I hear Republicans say that, what I hear is the sacrifices that you made to stay home with your children are not worthy. You're only worthy if you are in an office. And that, to me, is the worst messaging that Republicans have put forth over the course of the last, you know, 5 years having these conversations, is completely delegitimizing the critical role that stay-at-home mothers play, and stay-at-home fathers play too, in their children's development and emotional development, all of those things. And continuing to push forth that messaging makes me, as a woman, and we're more emotional creatures, it makes me, it's true.
No comment.
It makes me shut down and say, like, that person does not understand my family and they don't care about my family. And so those are the two things that I would caution Republicans against, because I just think it's really bad messaging.
Yeah, sometimes you'll see, it seems like every month or so, you'll see a piece about like the wasted potential of what our GDP could be if we just got our you know, female labor force participation rate even higher. And it does sometimes lapse into that idea of, well, it's only true work if it's for pay and you know, managing. I think between the panelists up here, we would have enough kids to populate an entire professional 11-on-11 soccer game. So that would be fun to see. But Tim, let's bring you in here. You know, Ramesh talked a little bit about some of the libertarian brain that happens on conservative circles, where having kid is a consumption decision, just like buying a boat or getting a puppy dog or whatever you want to do. But there's a grain of truth to some of the critiques, and they'll say, well, look at Hungary or Poland or Sweden or Japan or South Korea, or go down the list. They've tried to boost birth rates by increasing family benefits, and it's been only marginally successful at best. Is there a case for expanding the child tax credit or providing a baby bonus where you're getting an upfront payment at the time your baby is born, something along those lines where it's explicitly pro-family policy, even if it doesn't nudge our birth rates whatsoever? Is there a case for that?
I mean, I think on multiple levels you can make the case. First, on birth rates, I've really studied this, and what I've come to believe is that the only way through kind of fiscal policy you can nudge birth rates up, I could see two possible ways. One is just give people money without conditions. But B, know that it's going to be really expensive. And it might only work in the short term. I think Hungary's lesson is that if people are already married, they're religiously minded, and it's budget that's keeping them from having kid number three or four, that this money can help. For a lot of other people, just speeds up birth. It's a cultural problem to a large extent. But you can, through, but there's a basic fairness argument for a child tax credit that's a little bigger than the one we have now, which is that if you, in my book and in a Wall Street Journal piece I wrote, there was this guy I used to play baseball with, and he and his buddies lived in the neighborhood of Montgomery County. My first neighbor was there. I was like, why do you live there? It's the most boring place in the world. It's like, oh, we found this big house to rent. Like, we each get our own bedroom, and it's so much cheaper. And so this house of five dudes was living next door to a family of five. And if they made $125,000 between the five of them, because they were like bartenders, Uber drivers, they would, without a child tax credit, have the same income as the house next to them and pay half as much taxes because of the standard deduction and the tax brackets and that sort of thing. So to simply create a $3,000 tax credit would be to more or less equalize the tax treatment. It's to acknowledge that children are people and not consumption. And I had a liberal, actually.
They're also future taxpayers.
Well, I mean, they are future taxpayers and future workers. But also, if my daughters decide to be future stay-at-home wives and not drive up the labor force participation, that's incredibly valuable in itself. And another thing, I think, and so I just want to drive home that point as well. If Republicans became the party of, hey, we need more stay-at-home moms and dads too, I think that would be a big winner, because guess what? A sizable number of married mothers want to be stay-at-home moms. Not most of them, but a sizable number of them. Most Americans think America would be better off if there were more stay-at-home parents. About 1% of credentialed journalists in Washington, D.C. think America would be better off with stay-at-home parents. I think it would be a countercultural in this, it would be countercultural in this environment, but it would be a winner, and not just in Utah, but it would be a winner. It'd be like, and I remember Blake Masters got attacked by a local Democratic Party for saying, it would be great if more families could afford to have a single breadwinner. If you say, more of you should stay at home, that's a loser. But if you say, you know what, it should be easier. And that's why a child tax credit increase is better than the child independent care credit, because that says, if you do 40 hours a week and formal daycare, you get a tax credit. I'd rather say, if you decide that mom is going to work less, or if you decide that the dad's going to take a job that's more flexible, or if you decide to build a granny flat, though some people think, oh, I don't want a tax credit to enable my mother-in-law to move in next door to me. Most people actually do want their mother-in-law to live next door to them to help them raise their kids. If you're anything, or buy a house closer to family. So that's one reason, I mean, I think to say there are lots of family moms, and a lot of people are going to sacrifice work for spending time with their kids, and that's not bad. I think that would be great messaging for Republicans.
Congressman, I don't want to put you on the spot, but in case there's anything you want to add to any of the conversation you've been having, or if you've said your piece, that's fine too.
No, I think it's an interesting point. We just saw Harrison Butker, the kicker for the Chiefs, say exactly what you just said, trying to get canceled, and I don't think it was successful. I don't think the canceling of him was successful for saying, some of you in this audience that are graduating are going to want to stay. He said it exactly like you did. There's nothing controversial. And I do feel like there's a bit of a reckoning within our society that's like, whoa, 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 we went a little woke. Let's pull that back a little bit. And, you know, it didn't help their performance in the Super Bowl.
I think he had 0 points.
But, yeah. But that was it's an interesting piece. And it's a good externality that comes from legislation like this, to get back to what, you know, I experienced as a kid, because my mom was a stay-at-home. She abhorred the fact that she went back to work once I was like in like sixth or seventh grade. It was a time when things got more expensive because we had older kids were starting to go to college, and she had the flexibility to go back to work. She personally hated it. And she always kind of quibbled with herself. And I'm like, Mom, relax. Like, I'm at school. You can be working. That's no problem. Just when I forget my Mitt, just be able to go home and get it for me before my game today, which happened frequently, she'll attest. But like, I feel like society is helping. This is a part of, you know, furthering that. It doesn't solve it. Cost of living is so much that, and you can also look, you know, is dual income just, you know, making cost of living in general more? Like, that's for an economist outside of this conversation to figure out. But if we can make it so that isn't, you know, totally looked down upon, that's a good externality from this type of legislation.
And the concern about work, is, by some conservatives, the way I try to find a middle ground there is, if a larger child tax credit drives down workforce participation, that might or might not be bad. It's good if it means dad then takes a 30-hour week job so he can be home when the school bus drops off, or mom becomes a stay-at-home mom, or vice versa. But the legitimate concern by, like, our AI colleague Scott Winship is, if there's somebody being raised by a single mother and the mother never works, the child is then raised without an example of a working parent. And this is basically the definition of intergenerational poverty. Now, on the other hand, if mom is working 70 hours to pay for everything, then the child is raised without a present parent, which is the definition of all sorts of. So once you're in that position of a single mom raising kids, there's no good solution. There's a least bad solution. And that's a complicated thing that policymakers have to work around. How do we take care of this family without providing bad incentives? But you have to sort of, don't let that worry about bad incentives for that, you know, single mother guide all policymaking, including for married parents.
I like the congressman's language about externalities, because I think, you know, this is a concept from economics where if there's a social externality, it's being privately underprovided. But the benefits would be greater to society. So having kids, I think, is a perfect example of an externality. Parents bear the cost of having kids individually with the diapers and the childcare and the school uniforms and all the rest. But generations down the road, and the congressman's eyes light up, and they become job creators and entrepreneurs and all that, taxpayers, all the rest, that is something that society really benefits from. And so I think there's a case, just on pure economic terms, before we even get into some of the, you know, more normative claims about the importance of family, to have something like the child tax credit. And when we talk about this, I'll just spend a minute here getting into the weeds before people's eyes glaze over. There's two dimensions on which we can talk about modernizing the CTC. One is improving or increasing the top line number, right? So right now it's $2,000 per child. That's scheduled to go down to $1,000 if Congress doesn't do anything when the TCJA expires at the end of this year. If we had just indexed it for inflation back in 2017, that would be worth $2,500 today. So already that's starting to erode over time. You could imagine increasing it up to $3,000 as in the Family First Act, or, you know, we've seen even higher numbers thrown out by other folks on Capitol Hill. We can dream big. But that's one dimension, right? But the other is what we do for families at or below the median income. And that's where we get, if you owe federal income tax liability, it's very easy. If you owe $5,000 and you have two kids, two times $2,000 is $4,000. And so you would subtract that, you only owe $1,000 in federal taxes. But if you only owe $1,000 or $2,000 in federal income tax to start with, what do we do with that difference? Right now, you get part of that back via a refundable check. That's what's known as the additional child tax credit, or the ACTC. And so if we're talking about blue-collar parents with a stay-at-home parent, blue-collar families with a stay-at-home parent, or a single mom who's working 35 hours a week, somebody who's making only $40,000, $35,000 a year, those are the people right on the margin of, you know, that ACTC, that additional refundable child tax credit, being a really big part of what it takes to sustain family life. And so, Ramesh, I'll turn to you. As the Republican Party continues to realign, as they say, along educational lines, and we're seeing working class minority parents realign towards the GOP and college educated voters slide more leftwards, is there a political opportunity? Do you see the conversations happening where people are recognizing this is not the GOP base of 10, 20, 30 years ago? And is there a you know, rationale for focusing on this kind of stuff?
Well, I think Einstein said that compound interest is the most powerful force in the universe, but I think actually inertia may be the most powerful force in the universe. And I don't think Republicans have quite caught up to the change in the, let's say, class composition and the family basis of the voting base. You know, we talk as though there's been this huge change in Republican policymaking, and it's much more pro-family and much less focused on the old priorities. But the fact is, it's not just that the child credit is worth less in real inflation-adjusted terms than it was in 2018. The pro-family provisions of the tax code are worth less than they were in 2005. I mean, we have seen a steady erosion. Well, I shouldn't say steady because it jumps up when you do things like the 2017 thing. But the overall trend, because of inflation and other changes in the tax code, like the abolition of the dependent exemption, has been downward. So we've got a smaller pro-family tax benefit than we used to have. The other thing you have, there's this very odd thing that happens with conservatives, where all of a sudden the main tax that most Americans pay, which is the payroll tax, not the income tax, just disappears entirely from the analysis. And so any tax credit you get in excess of your income tax liability, that's a handout, that's a giveaway. And even if you leave aside the question of the fact that, the country does need future taxpayers, future soldiers, future workers, it just ignores the fact that these families are paying payroll taxes, and they're paying significant amounts of payroll tax. And not only that, they are paying this payroll tax for these old age programs. Now think about what these old age programs involve. They mean you are no longer taken care of, as in, 120 years ago, by the kids that you invested in raising. You're taken care of by everybody's kids, right? You are free riding on the financial sacrifices of other people to have had and raised children. That's another kind of externality that needs to be compensated for. It's a reason why you have studies that suggest that the expansion of these old age programs actually suppress childbearing because they reduce that incentive to have kids of your own. And so just getting back to that point about externalities, there's another reason why you need a big child credit, and it should not just apply against income taxes, but it should apply against all federal taxes, including your payroll taxes, including your employer side payroll taxes. And that's what actually gets us closer toward neutrality.
Just a quick math point. I was just doing this last night because my daughter's writing a paper where she has to argue for and against full refundability of a child tax credit. I think she's now officially a liberal because she's just, which is good. Your child at age 17 and 18 should probably be a liberal and then become a conservative. But we figured out that a family of four with $50,000 of income, so this is 1.5 times the poverty rate, would have $2,000 taxes normally, but $4,500 in payroll taxes. So if they had three tax credits, they'd still, all of that would just be reimbursing them, if they were a family of five, just be reimbursing them for the taxes they pay. And then, as Ramesh just said, if you wanted to go further, their employers are already paying a portion of the other portion, which comes out of their wages. So.
Bethany, you talked a little about this already. You mentioned Elon, you mentioned Vice President Vance, and this growing sense that birth rate decline is a real civilizational problem. But we also heard, maybe people aren't having babies just for the child tax credit alone. I think that's probably true. Can you talk a little bit about this sort of social pronatalism that you're seeing, that you're a part of, and how something like this, something a signature achievement for families, could help kind of put wind in that sails?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of it is what I discussed earlier, I think the biggest crisis that we're facing as Western civilization is, and J.D. Vance talked about it in his speech at the March for Life, is that we've become an anti-life and anti-optimism society. That, having children is the ultimate expression of optimism in our future, and pessimism has just completely taken root, especially on the left. If you go into a museum gallery, you're likely to see someone throwing, spaghetti sauce on a Monet or something because they think that the apocalypse is coming. We have an opportunity on the right to be the joyful warriors, to be the happy people who say, I'm excited for our future. And we're seeing that messaging a lot from Republicans. It was the cover of The New Yorker, where it was like the MAGA, remember the like the angry MAGA, and it's like all these kids who are just smiling and happy. Like that is the future, and Republicans need to become that party of optimism and hope. And you know, that's what drove Barack Obama into the White House, was hope and change. We have to co-opt that. We have to become this party that, like, if you want a future that is joyful, that come with us. But at the same time, I feel like, as you know, as a mother who's paying for eggs every week, you're using the financial burden of being an American and being anyone now, because eggs are expensive everywhere. But you're not then saying, like, we have a solution. There was a lot of complaining, justifiably, that led into the election, but now Republicans have to be the party of solutions. And this was a massive missed opportunity with Obamacare. They complained, but then when they got control of Congress, they did nothing, and they were punished for it. So let's go into this next 2 years where we have control over the executive branch and the legislative branch and, like, I don't know, not the judicial, but whatever. We have control here. Make it count. Make it possible for Americans to think they can do this crazy thing of having one or two kids. And one or two kids is a gateway. Once you get the one or two, you're like, I don't know, I could have the third, I could have the fourth. And I saw...
It's called Stockholm Syndrome.
I saw Lila Rose say, propose the idea of, you have four kids, you don't pay any federal income tax at all. As a mother of six, I would love that. But I think a lot of the issue with our birth rate is getting people's feet in the door. And once you get a hit of that newborn baby smell, like, you want to keep going back more and more and more. And I think, had six. I think that is the key, is the messaging. At the end of the day, like, I'm not going to have a fourth or fifth baby because of, I actually might have done that. The no income tax actually might have tipped my scales to having that fourth. But at the end of the day, people are not going to have babies for the financial benefits. And I think that's why we're seeing across the world, when they are introducing financial incentives, they fall flat. Because at the end, you have to give people the hope and the want. And if Republicans step forward with that hope and positive messaging, I think it will inevitably come. And having people like J.D. Vance, having Ivanka Trump, who's gorgeous, and talking about staying home with her kids, like, that is how we get this done, is the messaging.
I'll just end, because I'm going to step out. But in Utah, when you get to three, they still ask if you're going to have four. When you get to four, they stop asking, but they're not surprised when you have five. So there's a tipping point in Utah's culture as well. It's not based on anything other than societal, religious background.
Yeah, you do it.
Thank you all. I'm going to step out. Continue on.
Thank you. I just wanted to know, you know, one of the things that when people look at these cross-national comparisons of pro-family, pro-natal policy, and whether they've worked, one of the things that I think you really have to correct for is what that society's pre-existing ideal family size is. We live in a country where survey after survey consistently suggests that most people want to have more kids than they ended up having. So we're not in a situation where we're trying to use the tax code or other levers of policy to bribe people into doing something that they don't want to do. We are trying to figure out if there are obstacles that are getting in the way of their doing what they do want and taking those obstacles out of the way for them.
Tim, I'm going to come to you next, and then we'll open it up to questions here. But I'll just put a point on this discussion to say, if you're concerned about the decline in fertility, which I hope that you are, because you should be, the upstream cause of that is not people in marriages having fewer kids. It's fewer people getting married in the first place. And so in this context, I think it's important to remember that declining fertility rates are being driven primarily by declining marriage rates. And if there's ways we can be thinking...
And people getting married later.
Getting married later or not getting married at all. And especially among people without a college degree. And so I think that's probably beyond the scope of this Congress to do much about this year, but it's worth keeping the back of our minds to be thinking about in the future. Tim, a thought on this question politics downstream from culture, culture downstream from politics?
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, the mayor is saying if, so a work requirement is an opportunity to be pro-marriage.
Yes.
Because if, oh, I'm a single mother, I marry a guy with a job, and suddenly I hit the work requirement.
If it's a household work.
If it's a household work requirement. And so, now, if you are, if Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez walks by, she says, this right-wing guy is trying to get a woman to marry her abusive baby daddy. That's that dark side of the left that can't see anything positive. My knee-jerk reaction is always to be like, oh no, I'm not trying to push anything. But at some point, you just have to be like, your vision of marriage, family, commitment, the future is all dark, it's all wrong. And we need to embrace family is good. Yes, there are lots of circumstances that are abusive, that are bad, but family is good, okay? And so that has to be some of the pushback. But, I mean, Utah's a great example. My old neighborhood in Montgomery County, right next to the two Orthodox, modern Orthodox Jewish synagogues, is another great example where this one person was trying to explain why they had three kids when they only thought they were going to have one. They're like, it's kind of contagious. All of our friends have three, and then there's this other group of people that all has five or six, and I think they do it because they all have five or six. Mm-hmm. And in Utah, again, somebody once told me four is the new six, someone in Farmington, and yeah, then it kind of becomes normal. And so culture is going to normalize this, and this is why a little nudge from fiscal policy could theoretically, I'm not going to promise it, could theoretically have a broader effect. And there's very little Congress can do to encourage marriage, but I think getting rid of all marriage penalties, and our colleague, I mentioned him earlier, Scott Winship has written about that, Lyman Stone has written about it, but if the work requirement and any refundability thing is a family work requirement that takes into account the husband, then that's definitely pro-marriage, and thus, in the long run, pronatal. But final warning, that 2.7 that Gallup has, as the ideal number of kids in a family, Americans say is 2.7. I think that will fall over time faster if we don't reverse the fertility decline today. That as families get smaller and marriage gets later, that becomes self-fulfilling.
Yeah, and then that becomes a very, very difficult problem for society.
It becomes self-correcting.
Well, we're almost running on time, which is kind of incredible. I'm going to open it up for questions now.
We're all going to be snowed in, and we're just going to keep talking.
That's my dream.
I've got enough talking.
A whole day of talking about the child tax rule. The snow falls out the window. We'll start with David. Go ahead.
Sure. David Edison Scannon. It seems like a lot of the individual tax provisions right now being discussed by GOP either focus on a narrow set of populations, so tip workers, overtime, or just say, we're stopping your taxes from going off by avoiding this fiscal cliff. So can you maybe from like a raw Machiavellian political perspective talk about the value of the CTC in terms of just showing Republicans being able to demonstrate, hey, we actually improved your own tax filing next year versus just avoiding the fiscal cliff?
Well, I also think just coming out and saying as loudly and in every way as possible that we have a vision of the good life. And it's not that everybody has to do this, but in general, adults getting married and having kids, and again, I don't prescribe this for everybody. I always say, as a Catholic, all of my favorite priests are unmarried and have no kids. And so not everybody is called to this, but as a general vision of the good life that includes marriage and kids, we believe in that. And sort of the Machiavellian thing is, like I always thought DeSantis and to some extent Trump, their magic power is getting the other side to attack them for something very normal. Yeah. Get the libs to be like, why are you prescribing this to everybody? Be like, I don't know. I feel like marriage and family is good. And guess what? All of your voters in Chevy Chase, Maryland think that too. They just won't say it out loud. And that would be my sort of Machiavellian things. Come out in favor and say, you think we're subsidizing marriage and family? Guess what? We think marriage and family is good.
Mm-hmm. You just more on the Machiavellian thing. It polls well. The child credit pulls better than most tax cuts, particularly if there is some sort of work requirement, although, of course, how you design that is important policy-wise. It also, if you want to keep people from having a tax increase, you have to do it, right? There's just no way of making these numbers work. The reason you could say TCJA cut taxes for most people is primarily because of the child credit expansion. But then the other thing, and I think that we do need to make this point, is that we are losing ground every single day because of inflation. And we have not stopped tax increases. It's not a question of future tax increases. We've already had the tax increases on families because, again, over the last 20 years, families with kids have picked up more and more of the tax burden.
I think also with suburban women, that is like the number one, you know, target for everyone, right or left. And we tend to swing wildly one way or the other. And Roe was a scary moment, I think, for a lot of Republicans who were realistic, because it really endangered that voting bloc. And Republicans have to say, we are pro-family, we are pro-baby. That is, I think, the best messaging that Democrats have against Republicans, is that you are anti-woman and you only want a baby to be born, but at the end, then you walk out of the room and you're not engaged with making it possible for that woman to raise that baby the way that it deserves to be raised. And this to me is the best messaging from a political perspective, but also just from a moral perspective. Like, no, we are the party of family. We are the party of babies. We think that they should be born, and then we want to make sure that babies are able to be supported.
And there is evidence that a baby bonus, like a tax credit that comes upon the birth, is pro-life. It reduces the number of abortions.
Yeah, I'll just... Bethany's point is excellent, and I'll just put a pin on it to say the child tax credit, by its very nature, is more egalitarian than some of the other responses that we've seen in the wake of Dobbs' proposals to make IVF free for all or expand the child tax credit or child care credit for businesses that provide, you know, child care. Those sort of things, very narrow, targeted benefits that can get very expensive, are not as, you know, in the realpolitik world, is not as beneficial as something you can run on and say, look, we doubled the size of the child tax credit. I mean, it was pulling teeth to get the CTC and TICTA the first time around. And then after it was passed, everybody was running on it and pointing to the tremendous success in doubling the child tax credit. Salience matters. And so that's why the baby bonus and expanding the child tax credit, being able to point to it and say, this is our signature achievement, I think can actually create some of the momentum that we're looking for.
Well, and to pile on that, both Biden's and Congressman Moore's tax credit are more concentrated in the first 5 years,
right. Yeah.
Which, A, for the significant portion of the electorate, especially suburban moms who are going to use child care and dual incomes in those first 5 years, well, that's kind of a daycare subsidy. But then also for the ones who are going to stay at home, it's a stay-at-home subsidy at the same time. Stay at home until they get to kindergarten, it's a stay-at-home subsidy. And it becomes more salient and can be more of an induction to having babies.
Go ahead.
Matthew Henry, appreciate everyone being here and having this discussion. I lived a good life. I got married. Dating said, you can work at home. That's going to be your job, full-time job. I lived that entire life. 8 years later, we still didn't have a child. We were infertile. Paid tons and tons of money into our own monies into the system. My wife still wasn't working outside the home, so we had one income. And then finally, I remember coming down the stairs. We stopped everything because we couldn't afford it anymore. And we said, "Okay, what are we gonna do?" And so she said, "I think I'm pregnant." I said, "There's no way." She was pregnant. We had her. I went down the stairs of our home in South Carolina and just bawled because I was like, "There's no way." Had our first child. 2.5 years later, that my wife, she died of cancer. So I became a single dad, and in a picture of having a situation where I believed in a good life. I had a church, I had a job, I had a child now, 2.5 year old to take care of. So I think the picture I get, the picture of the conservative with the family first, babies first, I love that. But in practicality, there has to be, I don't know what you call it, wraparound or what that has to be, there has to be everything considered. So it's about IVF, it's about infertility, it's about, you know, I cried because I was like, this culture, this world that my son's coming into, he's 30 now, retired, that's another long story. So, and we homeschooled, by the way, so we homeschooled all of our kids. So we did that all on one person's income. And that was really, really tough. We had to sacrifice a lot of things. So there's a lot of programs. I love the payroll tax questions because, you know, we pay all that tax and all that money, you know, will hopefully someday come back. But what is that message as a whole package? When you talk about Bethany, childcare. We're taking 36 kids now. You know, you talk about the IVF.
I'm going to package that really tightly for Ramesh. Can you talk a little bit about this idea and also just cost of living in general and how pro-family messaging kind of fits into that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that once you start thinking about, you know, there was an economist who said once you start thinking about economic growth, it's hard to think of anything else. Once you start thinking about a pro-family set of policies, you see all kinds of places where it could make a difference. So obviously, I think the child tax credit is very important, but there's so many things that we could be doing. One thing that we could be doing that I think is pretty urgent is making it easier, that is to say, making it more legally possible to build houses around our country, which makes it possible for young people to decide, you know, we could afford a house. Maybe we should get married and start a family and begin this process. I do think that there are things we could do about childcare, particularly deregulating it in the places where it is highly regulated.
Like Washington, D.C.
Even things like, you know, we think about occupational licensure, you know, the fact that you have to get all this training to be certified by the government to be a cosmetologist, for example, or even in some jurisdictions in this country, to be a fortune teller, which is really funny, like since it's a job that you literally cannot be good at. But even that, you know, that's the sort of thing where if we made it easier for people to do it, they might be able to envision themselves having this kind of family life. So I think really sort of across the range of policy areas, there are things that we can and should be doing once we start thinking in terms of what are these obstacles and how can we knock them down.
I think also, I mean, as a conservative, I think at the end of the day, the government is not the best provider of these social support systems. I read a book that was really good that I think Tim might be more familiar with. But, I mean, we need to encourage our social support structures so that, you know, when you have that horrible situation happen, you have a community surrounding you that is holding you up. I want to throw the baton to Tim.
Nothing is going to replace human-level community and support systems. Like, my youngest is in second grade now, and so my wife spends all of her time walking around the neighborhood and stealing other people's babies to hold. And when we have had problems and crises, you know, it got to the point where our kids were like, do you remember that week that Eve was in the hospital? We never ate so well before or since. I had one guy tell me that when he got his neighbor got diagnosed with cancer, his neighbor started bringing over all the casseroles because they wouldn't fit in his second freezer. And there isn't a government program that can replace that. And so this is a really unsatisfying answer for congressional members and chiefs of staff. But again, that's why I think sort of the working around the edges is always going to be the thing. And that an image, a vision, rhetoric matters. The fact that there have been 3 commercials in the last year that like have literally made me cry because they're about having babies be good makes me think this is where we need to pull the vibe shift towards. Yes. is that, and not just get married and have kids, but hey, it's your duty to help other people who are engaged in this as well.
Got time for about 2 more questions. Yeah.
Hey, my name's Anna Lillian. I work at Economic Security Project, and this is hitting home for me on a whole lot of levels. I'm a child of immigrants, and we had a daycare center in our house, so I came home from school with help. I was lucky enough to have a kid, and unfortunately, with a deadbeat dad, so I had to get divorced. So I'm curious about 2 questions in terms of pro-family encouragement. One is, what's your stance on immigrant families, both those with and without Social Security numbers, those who are working, filing with I-10s, because there's a big debate about that. And then second, head of household. Because I do think perhaps you had to file with head of household. That's what I did too. I wanted to be married, but it didn't work out. So love your stance on that.
I'll just toss out a quick answer, and I think these are both really complicated aspects of the CTC, and I do think we're going to see some action around them, for better or for worse. But on head of household specifically, I think there's ways that you can consolidate that in ways that, you know, I like the congressman's terminology of modernizing the CTC. If you increase the CTC a given amount, you can actually get rid of head of household, make that more streamlined, and hold almost all families harmless, except for maybe the most wealthy. I'll point you to our friends over at the Niskanen Center who have done a paper that works out the budget math. But in general, having a more streamlined tax code and getting rid of some, you know, CDC, TC, head of household, some of these other things is actually, you know, again, you have to pay for it by increasing the child tax credit. That's necessary. But just increasing the child tax credit isn't also sufficient for making it more pro-family. Having a more streamlined tax code lessens some of the mental load and administrative burden and some of the just errors that kind of trip people up when they're filing taxes. So I'd love to see us shift in that direction. I think that's a pretty big swing for this time around. I'm not sure, unlike 2017, when there was a lot of appetite for really big systemic reform of the tax code, I don't sense that there's that same energy this time around. But there's, I would like to see that conversation continue.
Because you mentioned immigration, I'm going to throw out an idea that might be really politically unpopular, and it's one reason why I don't run for office. But I think our immigration policy, this isn't precisely what you asked, but I think our immigration policy should be more oriented towards families that want to come here and raise their children to be Americans. And so that's not a Chamber of Commerce immigration policy. That is a, out there, how many people are there saying, I want to live in America, not just because there's good jobs, not just to send money home, but to come, bring my kids, raise them to be Americans, heck, I'll learn the rules of baseball and football, and as I put in a recent article, they should cry when they get to the end of Rocky IV. Like that's, and that would be a pro-family immigration thing, which might not raise the, I mean, it probably would, but it wouldn't raise the labor force participation as much as just importing workers. But that's something that I would like to see that would be pro-immigrant, pro-family, and super patriotic, because these would be immigrant visas for families and not just guest worker visas. I would make a one-to-one trade on all these.
I suspect, I could be wrong, but I suspect that what you were getting at was the question of who would be eligible for the child credit and verification systems for legal residents. And I think the politics of that are just going to be enormously tricky, and I don't want to let them get in the way of the larger goal of an expansion that benefits tens of millions of people. Look, I think there's all kinds of things that we need to do about illegal immigration and our immigration system generally. I don't think that whether you're talking about a $2,000 credit or even a $3,000 credit, particularly since it's not all going to be probably available to everybody at the lower end of the labor market, I don't think that's a huge magnet for illegal immigration. I think it's a pretty ancillary issue. So I am not concerned that you're going to have lax eligibility that increases illegal immigration. But I do think the politics of getting it through without some kind of tight ID requirement are going to be very, very hard.
In part because that knee-jerk reaction against unearned benefit, that's very strong on the right, among Republican members of Congress, among the average American voter. What they're really concerned about is somebody getting something they don't deserve, whether it's a millionaire, somebody getting a USAID subsidy, or some, you know, non-working illegal getting a tax credit.
And that was part of the backlash, too. I think the 6 months where we had a universal CTC under the Biden administration. All right, I got time for one. Who's got the best question that we can end on? Or I'll take the second best question we can end on, too.
It looked like it was going to be a great question.
Yeah. But I'm thinking of a New York Times article that talks about the loneliness crisis, about how since COVID, rates of Americans like hanging out in person, spending time together, is just really sharp, like never really recovered. And I was thinking about that in relation to like things like marriage and babies. And Bethany's point that, you know, we want to see a political party that is optimistic. How do you all what is sort of the vision for inspiring even just social confidence or whatever it is that people seem to be lacking, that they're not going out and forming these connections that are then the basis for?
So I think that was an excellent question, and I'm glad that you asked it. I think that is so much of the crisis that we're seeing now. And I think that this is not why President Trump is doing it, but making everyone come back to the office and interact in person. I think that there is going to be a side benefit to that, that people need to start interacting again in person. There is a huge backlash against, and I'm biased because I literally wrote a book about it, but I think that there is a huge backlash against everything that happened during COVID and after COVID. And I mean, I talk to my single friends and, you know, there's a lot of frustration that they're not able to meet someone who is marriage minded and who wants the things that they want out of life. There was another New York Times interview with someone from Brooklyn, I think, and they said it feels like the rules have changed. Everyone is still operating under the assumption that, you know, what Tim was saying, that marriage is good, family is good, all these things, but it feels like the rules have changed, and how do I catch up to that? And I think that encouraging more in person and forcing people to come back to work, and, you know, making sure that there is that incentive to meet people and get out there more, and rolling back a lot of that COVID stuff that led us to this point, I think is a net positive, even if they're not. That wasn't the intention.
As an introvert, I have to say, though, I have the opposite of a loneliness crisis. No, it's a very, very important question. You're talking about it among younger people, but think about it among older people. And that is a problem that is going to be made so much worse by falling birth rates. You're going to have so many more people now who are not going to have grandkids. You know, sometimes people talk about, well, you know, the research shows that parents aren't actually happier. It's a contestable issue. Grandparents are way happier. The non-grandparents, and you can't become a grandparent if you didn't have kids.
As an extrovert, I mean, what's the solution going to be? And as a Catholic, Irish Catholic, I was just thinking, well, alcohol can help.
The right setting, too.
The right setting. One of the problems is work from home is actually pronatal. And so we're like, well, maybe you just force all the single people to come. Again, there are problems with that as well. So alienation as defined by, Robert Nisbet had a great definition of it, which was, it's not only the lack of interest in society, it's lack of even understanding why you would need it. And anybody who's on Twitter encounters this, where somebody's like, no, I mean, just be rational. You can just use the internet to not realizing why you need to rub shoulders with your colleagues, why you want to have friends who you have to bump into or neighbors that you have to bump into without choosing it, especially in our rationalistic, hyper-individualistic world, that Nisbet were warning about alienation is even stronger. And how to overcome it, again, I mean, can we subsidize who's ever making these Super Bowl ads and be like, wow, it really is nice to accidentally bump into a neighbor? I don't know.
Well, as you can tell, we brought three of the sharpest and most creative minds in D.C. working on these questions. Very grateful for you joining, I think, thanks to the congressman and staff as well. If you want to engage in this conversation, please feel free to reach out to me. We have a weekly newsletter called Family Matters on Substack. You're welcome to subscribe to that as well. But my email is on the bottom of those sheets that you've received, and you can also feel free to spam these guys as well. But first, please join me in thanking them for our great conversation.